that he shares with one other of the present regents, his immediate superior, Ambassador Ed Pauley, and with myself, the honor of being the only ones who have ever been in Bolshevik Russia. That being the case, I think I need say nothing about Bolshevik Russia, having with us a very much finer authority on the subject. President Sproul needs no introduction. He needs no praises. You can give him that. And so I merely present to you the president of the University of California.
Thank you, Mr. Lowell. I'm going to have to stand in front of you, I think, huh?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Perkins, friends, whatever Mr. Rowell may say about me, the only authentic cachet of recognition and significance in the San Francisco Bay Area is to be invited to speak before the Commonwealth Club. Until that invitation has been extended, a man is never quite sure that what he has done was worth doing. So it was a relief to me to find on my return from Europe a letter from Mr. Ward awaiting me, and I immediately put the club first on my too long list of speaking engagements, except for my own university family. Naturally, I was doubly glad that I had done this when I found that the San Francisco Center of the League of Women Voters had decided to join with the club at this meeting. What I shall tell you today will be much of it travelogue, some of it exposition, some of it perhaps argument, but the whole tied together, loosely at least, by the threads of my sincere interest in international understanding. Not international sentimentality or antagonism, but international understanding. When President Truman asked me to join the American Reparations Group, he explained to me that my function thereon would be to represent the human values, to see that any reparations plan adopted should not violate the conscience of the world, and especially the public opinion of the American people. By most people, this was taken to mean that I would specialize on the use for reparations of involuntary labor, slave labor, if you will, a form of reparations which had been sanctioned by Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill at the Yalta Conference. This was regarded generally as the hot potato of the negotiations, and I received, as I started for Europe, the generous commiseration of my friends. As it turned out, the USSR was so reluctant to discuss this kind of labor that the matter never came before the Commission, nor before the Big Three at Berlin. But the American Commissioner, Ambassador Edwin W. Pauley, did place on the record at Moscow, one, that the United States would not use slave labor in any case, and two, that it would not countenance, although it might not be able to prevent, the use of slave labor by other nations. Having early played my part in getting this declaration of principle on the books, I was assigned to the chairmanship of a committee on Germany's capacity to pay, and spent my time thereafter mediating between the industrialists and the economists in the American group, and between the British, the Russians, and the Americans in the Inter-Allied group. I perhaps would have had less trouble with the industrialists if each one of them had not received a clipping of a speech for the Honorable Claire Booth Luce, excerpted from the congressional record, denouncing me as a red unfit to be trusted in dealings with the Soviets. I broke down the prejudice thus engendered by distributing myself some editorials clipped from our student newspaper, proving that in American political and economic life, I stand just a little to the right of Herbert Hoover. So much for background. Now to set off on my 20,000 miles of travel, mostly by airplane. From Washington, D.C., our party of 35 flew by way of Bermuda and the Azores to England, where we spent 3 days to meet our British opposite numbers, to sound out their views, and innocently to lay the foundation for a Soviet suspicion that we were forming an Anglo-American bloc. We had an opportunity, too, to see the damage that had been done in London, which seemed very great until later we had a look at Stalingrad and Berlin. And also to become reacquainted with the bulldog breed, the common Englishman. May I report that he looked poorly nourished, shabby, tired, and a bit irritable, but I wouldn't count out or sell short any country in which he chooses to live and for which he chooses to work and fight. From England, we flew low over the Normandy beaches, Saint-Lô, Rouen, and so on, to Paris. As we looked down on the obstructions in the sea, which were originally supplemented by mines, thickly strewn and violently destructive, as we saw the heavy gun emplacements, the trenches and the pillboxes, the evidence of strong defenses everywhere, it seemed incredible that the landing should have been made, that the invasion should have been successful. Surely once these beachheads had been established, the German High Command must have realized that the might of the United Nations was irresistible and that the Nazi decision to carry on was sheer madness. This final frenzy of the Heron folk resulted in the heaviest war damage that France suffered. Saint-Lô is a flat field of rubble. Rouen lies in ruins, although from the air, it looked as if the cathedral might be relatively undamaged, and so on for many another little village and famed city. Paris itself, except for a strange shabbiness, was not changed in its externals. It was still a very pleasant place for the visitor, even with champagne at $18 a bottle. For the French, Paris and all of France, I am afraid, is sadly otherwise, with food rationed and very scarce, with fuel virtually unobtainable, and with a flourishing black market with astronomically high prices. From France, we went to Frankfurt am Main in Germany, flying low over intensively cultivated lands, which seemed to be producing good crops. The British food expert who accompanied us told us that it was one of the relatively few islands of plenty this area in the whole of Europe, and that there was no doubt that the coming few months would be a period of most serious food scarcity. My own later observations confirm this gloomy prophecy. Indeed, I cannot see how starvation is to be avoided in Germany this winter. Already, while I was there, the maximum ration, except for coal miners, was 1,150 calories per day. And the average for the cities was probably closer to 700. This compares with 3,600 for the United States. The cellar stocks undoubtedly supplement this supply, but they will not last for long. Meanwhile, the population in the western zone of Germany, which has always been a food deficit area, increases daily by the flight of persons from the eastern zone, which was the granary of old Germany, but which itself is now a deficit area. Nor do I believe that this deficit will be converted to a surplus for some years, for the terrain has been fought over almost inch by inch, and the Red Army not only lived on the land, but took away all farm labor, agricultural implements, and machinery. Frankfurt, still known as Scheif, the supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces, at that time was the first German city which we examined in detail. And we thought that no other city could have been smashed to such tortured rubble and fire-blackened walls. But we were wrong. Every large German city, almost without exception, is as bad or worse. An American officer commenting on the condition of the Reich told of a Negro reading a legend on a tombstone, not dead, just sleeping, who remarked he ain't fooling nobody but himself. In spite of this widespread destruction, German productivity kept going strong almost up to the end of the war. Indeed, in some vital industries, for example, airplane building, production in 1944 was higher than in 1939. This was made possible by the dispersal of plants, many of them right along the Swiss border, and by the building of factories underground. For example, we found at Mannheim a smoothly working power plant of a capacity large enough to supply all the needs of that large city, 58 feet underground, roofed by 10 feet of solid concrete, and overlaid by 30 tons of the coal which the plant used for fuel. It would have been impossible to spot this plant from the air, or to damage it even with atomic bombs, I think, if it had been spotted. Germans everywhere told me that the so-called saturation bombing of their homes and factories did not destroy their industry or result in many casualties or dampen their warlike spirit. In fact, it heightened that spirit after the first shock was over. It was the pinpoint precision bombing, especially of transportation centers and synthetic oil plants, that put them out of business. I met and talked with a large number of Germans, of course, military men and diplomats, high-ranking representatives of government, men of religion and men of commerce, laboring men and farmers, women and children. All had lived through the horror that was the last year of the war in Germany. Many were seared by the experience. Some seemed ignoble. But I didn't find a single one who had a sense of guilt or shame, any sober realization of the crime that had been committed against mankind. One man I met and talked with in Berlin was a rabbi who had spent 4 years in a concentration camp. He flamed with hatred for the Nazi gang and no vengeance upon the war criminals. The leaders would seem to him extreme. But he did not favor any reparations plan which would put heavy burdens on the German people, enslave ordinary members of the Nazi party, or even retard the return of Germany to her pre-war position in the politics and economy of Europe. Although he had experienced in his own person the horrors of Hitler's persecution of his people, he told me that he would have fought for Germany if he had had the chance. He was still a German patriot. He believed in his nation. He said it was all Hitler's fault. If we should never have let that monster come to power, but once he did, the good German people could do nothing about it. Knowing what I did, and seeing what I saw at Dachau and Buchenwald, this attitude was to me incredible. But there it is, and we shall have to take account of it for the next generation, at least. The German nation, like the German economy, is in chaos. And the people are groping blindly for the strong leadership to which they are accustomed, and which they have not been getting recently, at least in the United States zone. The United States military government, quite frankly, has been having its difficulties, which I hope may have been improved by the Berlin Protocol. USMG has been doing a magnificent ad hoc job, but it has sadly lacked information, one, as to whether the United States intends to stay in Germany for some time and to participate largely in its control and direction, or to withdraw shortly as it did after World War I, and two, as to the kind of Germany that the United States wishes to encourage, other than a peaceful Germany. This lack of a constructive program for the building up of a smashed country may well turn its people toward Bolshevism. The Germans know that this winter there will be hunger, cold, disease, and probably starvation. We know it too. In such crises, they are accustomed to quick decisions and energetic action on the part of government. They want to get to work, and they see no prospects of early work through our planning. In fact, they suspect us of having no planning at all. Consequently, they are beginning to look to the USSR, which they fear, but which seems to have more vigor to tackle their problems, which has set them to work cleaning up the ruins of their cities, and which encourages them to political activity and social reorganization along approved, that is, communist lines. My own opinion, for whatever it may be worth, is that the United States must, this time, take a major part in the occupation and control of Germany, and for some years. It must, but this need not mean large numbers of soldiers. The Red Army will take care of overawing the Germans. It must contribute to the force which will determine, as protocols and treaties never can, the conditions of German life for some time to come. And it must also, and this is much more important, lend encouragement in its own zone and elsewhere, if possible, to the building up of that kind of government, that way of life, which to Americans spells democracy. A kind of government under which labor and capital, rich and poor, all other kinds of people have a fair chance, in which the cards are not stacked permanently, either for or against the proletariat, the bourgeoisie, or any other group. A Europe of disarmed states, of disorganized states, of desolate and desperate states, constantly subject to propaganda, is a Europe ripe for revolution. If we do not enter promptly and vigorously and intelligently into this field of political and educational activity, communism will sweep Germany and all Europe, racked by cold and hunger and disease and anarchy. So much for Deutschland unter alles. And now for the victorious Russians. This is a much more difficult subject on which to speak. For I have already found to my sorrow that whatever you say, somebody disagrees with you and usually gets very angry about it. Let me begin, then, by emphasizing the fact that I am not an expert on Russia or on Russian-American relations. I do not speak Russian fluently, and for this and other reasons, I found it hard to learn much about Russia in the 39 days that I was in the country. Moreover, my work kept me in Moscow, and I saw practically nothing of the tremendous area of the USSR outside that city. I did see Stalingrad and Leningrad, and I was permitted by the Foreign Office and the NKVD, the omnipresent and omnipotent secret police, to take one or two short weekend trips in the country immediately surrounding Moscow. My impressions gathered from this inadequate sampling of Russian life are obviously not an adequate basis, for dogmatic conclusions. And to make it worse, those impressions are both contradictory and confusing. Though I have in my system no book on Russia clamoring for publication, no panacea for the strains that may be developing between the two most powerful countries in the modern world, the USA and the USSR. Only one thing I can assert positively, that is that what I tell you is direct and not hearsay testimony, All that I talk about, I have done or seen and not been told by someone prejudiced for or against the Soviet experiment. I met the Russians first at Frankfurt, where they had sent a crew in a Lend-Lease C-47 plane to transport me to Moscow. The landing was made at Hanau Field near Frankfurt in the spectacular way which I soon came to associate with Russian aviation. None of the crew could speak English, and so they landed on a crowded airfield without any word whatever from the control tower. The faces of the American ground crew were beautiful to watch. The landing was made at high speed. As all Russian landings seem to be, I made one at 165 miles an hour myself to a short runway and never expected to survive to tell you about it. I was placed on the plane along with my baggage and a lot of heavy trophies of war, Singer sewing machines, radios, cream separators, combined harvesters, and so forth. Not any of which were lashed down. The plane got off without any preliminary warming up of the motors. The freight load slid back a foot or two toward the tail. The heart of the live load, that's me, came up into its mouth. And we cleared the telephone poles and trees at the edge of the field by a good safe yard. Once in the air, we hedge-hopped a few hundred, not thousands of feet above the ground because the navigator said he preferred in that area to steer by landmarks and the ceiling was low. He remarked also that there were no meteorological reports available. The pilot's flying was technically and artistically perfect. But like his ideology, not at all conservative. We arrived at Berlin at about lunchtime. Berlin was our first and only stop. On arrival, the Russian crew went off and left me with the plane and without a word. They reappeared about 3 hours later in similar silence. Fortunately, I'd brought along a ham sandwich, because the lunchroom at the airport had been closed on VE Day. They were accompanied this time by four other Russians, three soldiers, one of them a woman, and one civilian. Except for the woman, who was taking no chances with an American, these new Russians were very friendly, and a pleasant conversation was built from my broken Russian and their badly bent English. They showed me the points of interest along the way, most of which seemed to be named Minsk or Pinsk, and endeavored to entertain me, not without success. It was on this first trip across Russia that I got the impression which nothing since has persuaded me to change, namely that any nation which sets out to conquer Russia has gone completely mad. Not only is the population of the country tremendously large and fertile, but the land itself is of vast dimensions and terrifying inhospitality. Miles of bleak forest and dreary swamp stretch to the horizon on every side. Long, slow, meandering streams traverse a landscape almost unmarred by human habitation. The occasional streaks of traveled earth, which take the place of roads, stretch seemingly from nowhere to nowhere, and their purpose is not evident, at least from a distance. Even with an atomic bomb, I should prefer to assault the moon. On arrival in Moscow, I was taken to the hotel in a truck driven by a powerful Russian woman, the first of many hundreds whom I saw doing most of the heavy work of that country. The hotel was as clean as European hotels are generally, and my room was not unpleasant. The food, was monotonous except for the caviar and vodka, but neither inadequate nor unwholesome. Shortly after I was established in the room, the maid hurried in and told me that I had better take a bath soon because the hot water was about to be turned off and would not reappear in the faucets for 3 days. Later, I discovered that this warning was unnecessary because water, hot or cold, never got up to my top floor room anyway. The people I met in the hotel and on the broad, clean streets to which I soon repaired were sturdy, mostly unsmiling, poorly clothed, but obviously intelligent and self-respecting. They had little sense of time, I discovered, but they moved energetically along the sidewalks nevertheless and seemed to be going somewhere, and I have no doubt that they are. The transportation system of Moscow was very much overcrowded, including the beautiful modern metro. There were long lines at the tram and bus stations and in front of the few movies and many rationing centers. Moscow, although in very bad repair as a result of years of war, is a beautiful, interesting, historic city. It fully justifies the pride which Russians all over the USSR take in it. As I told you, I saw Stalingrad also. Stalingrad was destroyed even more badly than any German city that we saw. Both the Russian and the German armies had swept it with shot and shell until nothing over 18 inches high was standing. The wreckage of tanks, trucks, motorized equipment lay all about. I was told that in the last year of the war, for some months thereafter, bodies lay unburied. Fortunately, they were frozen in the Russian winter, but the stench of the spring thaw still lingered. The living people of Stalingrad have returned in large numbers and are housed in wooden shacks and rubble huts. But they have rebuilt their school buildings and their children are at school. They have reopened their factories and products are already running off the assembly line. They were the only people I met in Russia who made even mild jokes about the Soviet system. I gave a cigarette, treasured gift, prized gift, to the foreman who sat next to me at luncheon and offered him my lighter. As usual, it failed to work. I then gave him a match, which he accepted, used successfully, and smilingly remarked, "Lighter like planned economy, match free enterprise." I'm not sure that I understand the subtleties of that statement, but it was grand to hear a Russian joke about his way of life, which so many Russians and so many Americans take with such painful seriousness. The trip to Leningrad was our first by railway since we had left the United States, and we were fortunate to go on the Red Arrow, best and most famous of Russian trains. We drew lots for the crowded accommodations. By the luck of the draw, I got a wagon-lit apartment, compartment in a so-called soft car, that is, a car with upholstery, which I shared with one male companion. I'll give you the point of that in a minute. Others, less fortunate, men and women indiscriminately, shared compartments for four, hardly larger in size, in a hard car. There is no diner on the train, but excellent tea, all Russian tea is excellent, was served free, and hors d'oeuvres were sold at high prices. Also beer at room temperature and $3.50 a bottle. At the numerous stations on the 17-hour trip, some of which the train stopped for as long as 30 minutes, peasants gathered to market their wares. You can buy eggs at 80 cents a piece, bread, milk, cheese, berries, and so forth. Or you can dispose of the food you have wisely carried along in a basket to hordes of beggar boys and girls who are inexpressibly grateful for a crust of bread. At one station, a can of Spam out of a U.S. Army ration was exhibited for 125 rubles, or about $10 in our money. A Red officer looked at it, turned away in disgust, and said, "I've been eating that stuff nearly every meal for 4 years. He'll get no 125 rubles from me." The train moved slowly, except through the towns, where it put on quite a show of speed. Barracks, factories, dachas, swamps, and birch groves streamed past the windows. The country reminded me of northern Maine or Wisconsin, with burned or cut over forests and scrubby undergrowth. The villages were rare and poor. The soil, except in the swamps, was dry and sandy. There were a few cows and occasional goats. The compartment next to ours on the train was occupied by two uniformed NKVD officials, a fat, important one, and a young, humble one with a dark, morose face. The fat one rarely left his compartment during the trip. The young one scuttled out occasionally at a station to buy food, his revolver flapping authoritatively at his side. Neither one of them spoke to me at any time during the trip. Needless to say, they too got off at Leningrad. Most of the other passengers were very pleasant, but we didn't talk much for obvious reasons. However, one night I produced a copy of the illustrated magazine America, written in Russian and published by the Office of War Information, and a lively meeting gathered in the corridor of the car. A party organizer took advantage of the ready-made crowd to deliver a speech telling how they had trusted Roosevelt, didn't know about Truman, and look at this fellow Hearst. We were all having a very nice time when suddenly they began looking guiltily over their shoulders, and the meeting quietly dispersed. As all impromptu meetings between foreigners and Russians quickly do. The other time that I got out of Moscow was on a picnic about 15 miles away on the Moscow River, in a large, lush meadow bordered by a forest with big trees and heavy undergrowth. We were warned to keep out of the forest as it had been recently mined. At the picnic, besides the British and American reparations groups and a few members of the Soviet group, there were the ever-present in-tourist girls and the men and women drivers of our automobile. We went swimming in the river, played catch, and overate, as is the custom of picnics the world over. Mosquitoes and ants were present to make us all feel at home. The Russian girls took part in the sports and pitched and caught as well as any man in the party. Wherever you meet them, these Russian girls challenge admiration, although I can't agree with Mr. Harry Hopkins that they are more beautiful than the American girl. After luncheon was over, the chauffeurs, men and women both, sang Russian songs, in which we soon joined, la 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 la, just like the second verse of the Star Spangled Banner. After the singing was over, we foreigners, with the aid of our interpreter and in the temporary unexplained absence of our keepers, engaged the drivers in a long and interesting conversation. It was soon clearly evident that they believe only two nations count today, the USA and the USSR. Nor was this mere politeness, for Britishers were present, and the Russians knew it. One after another, members of the group spoke up for a higher standard of living for themselves and a peaceful world for all mankind. They discussed frankly the possibility of war between the United States and the Soviets and were unmistakably eager that this should be avoided. They said we must not let our governments create quarrels. Remember, these were drivers of automobiles, not thinkers on a high political level. But I was tremendously impressed and sobered by what they said. Moreover, I am convinced by this and a few similar experiences in Russia, very few, I'm sorry to say, that the Russian people, as much as any European people and more than most, are ready and eager to like and trust Americans. What we and they need is to get better acquainted, to learn to know each other well. That has to be done by individuals, and they are ready to meet us halfway. I only wish their government would let them. But between them and the world beyond the borders of the USSR stands a regime, a government of unparalleled authority and ruthlessness. This regime knows better than anyone else what riches, what possibilities, what dangers lie in the Russian people. It holds these people, indubitably one of the world's greatest, completely in its hands. It is determined, moreover, that they shall not be influenced in any way from the outside. It teaches them not only to fear the power of external force, but also not to look to it for any aid or favor. The Soviet government must be the sole source of all gracious bounty for the faithful and of righteous wrath against the unbelieving and the undutiful, at least a million of whom convicted under Article 58 of the Soviet Constitution are today slave laborers in concentration camps. The whole system is devised to obviate the last or least possibility of foreign influence on the popular mind. So the fate of the world depends today on whether the Soviet government, not the Soviet people, choose the road to peace or the road to war. I believe that they will choose the road to peace, first because it is the safer road, and Stalin the realist has consistently avoided risks in his direction of the foreign affairs of the USSR. Second, because it is the better road, not only philosophically, but practically for a pioneer nation which still has its place to make in the world. I saw enough of Russia to convince me that it needs peace for years and years to achieve the purposes to which it is fanatically devoted, the justification of its ideology and system of government, and the attainment of a higher standard of living for its people. Peace and rebuilding are the most urgent needs of the USSR after the years of bloodletting and destruction. Stalin, I am sure, realizes all this and will act accordingly. If he does not, he will open up the sluice gates of disaster for Russia, for the United States, and for civilization. If he does, his credit in history will be greater than that of any dictator the world has ever known. And the years to come will be an era of pacification and recovery. I do not believe that he will miss his opportunity.
Your comment. Nothing further is needed.